Love as the universal force that can heal all forms of separation. Tao believes strongly in going inward and listening to your heart. But there's another path she's walked that seems to contrast with a life of meditation and yoga. Following one central belief, there is nothing you cannot do. Tao transformed her inner life into an incredible series of outward accomplishments. To list them all almost strains credibility. She was a peace activist marching with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Stage acting, including a career in Hollywood, took up a portion of her life starting in the 1950s, preceded by cabaret singing in London during World War II. But there were other career arcs. As a wife, when she became Tao Porchon Lynch, she was widowed in 1982 and has no children. As a ballroom dancer, specializing in the tango, for which she has won hundreds of first-place finishes, and perhaps most unlikely, as a wine connoisseur and writer. The one thing she shows little interest in is her longevity. "Don't focus on age," she says with a touch of impatience. "It doesn't exist." There's more, much more, but we're not introducing Tao simply as a remarkable achiever, not even as a beautiful example of a life lived with both peace and passion. Her achievements aren't likely to be duplicated by anyone else, and her historical time, often spent in close proximity to movie stars, writers, activists, and political leaders, won't come again. It's not what makes Tao unique that fascinates us, but what makes her an example everyone can follow. Strip away the uniqueness, and Tao has lived almost a century consciously shaping her own life. As a result, if you took a snapshot of any day in her long existence on Earth, you'd see someone who put her inner life first, trusted her feelings and intuition, valued the now as the source of constant renewal, cultivated emotional resilience, refusing to be stuck in old wounds and setbacks, activated her core beliefs, turning her vision into action, placed her trust in love and spiritual growth every day. We'd call this the model of a healing lifestyle. It's not that Tao hasn't had her share of painful experiences, beginning with the death of her mother, the loss of her husband, and on the physical level, 3 hip replacements. But instead of converting these experiences into suffering, she has consciously done the opposite. She has become even more dynamic and resilient. One might say that for Tao, only 2 kinds of experience exist. Not the good ones and the bad ones, the moments of pleasure and the moments of pain, but experiences she can celebrate and those she can heal. You can live your life the same way. Food for thought. Here's an everyday example of how the separation of mind and body creates practical difficulties in approaching a very familiar problem. Weight control. Millions of people flirt with fad diets, and millions more have struggled for years to lose weight and keep it off. How many times have you heard statements like the following? Perhaps you've made them yourself. I look in the mirror, and I hate what I see. My downfall is chocolate. It goes right to my thighs. After my divorce, I gained 10 pounds so fast I couldn't believe it. I've tried everything, but the weight just won't come off. I lose a few pounds, but then I plateau, and nothing happens. These are expressions of a society in which obesity has become epidemic, and in which diets don't work. Fewer than 2% of dieters successfully lose at least 5 pounds and keep it off for 2 years. Magazine editors No, they can increase sales by putting a new fad diet on the cover, promising how easy weight loss will be this time, thus feeding a fantasy that the public is all too willing to indulge in. Yet, amid all the worry, frustration, self-defeat, and wishful thinking that surrounds weight loss, why would uniting body and mind into the body-mind make a difference? Because the underlying problem isn't weight. Looking back at the typical statements listed above, all have in common that I am unhappy with it, the body, which turns the normal act of eating into a struggle between what the mind is trying to achieve and what the body is actually doing. Here's what the mind of a dieter is typically doing: fantasizing about how much weight the dieter will lose, believing that just one more try will do the trick, hating how the dieter's body looks, struggling to have more willpower, envying those who have perfect bodies, feeling guilty and ashamed about being overweight, promising to do better tomorrow, feeling trapped in bad eating habits that refuse to change. That's an enormous amount of mental activity to dedicate to a project, losing 5 pounds and keeping it off. That is predictably doomed to failure in the long run. Every bit of this activity is futile, because it ignores or weakens the mind-body connection. The mind is disconnected from what the body is actually doing, which looks something like this: processing more calories than it needs, coping with overloads of fat and sugar, adjusting to toxins in food, air, and water that often have unknown effects, dealing with low-level inflammation exacerbated by fast food and junk food, confronting the ups and downs of irregular eating during the day. The separation of mind and body isn't rare or harmless. It lies at the core of why diets don't work. This is a totally unnecessary situation. As a body-mind, each of us is naturally equipped to do what the body and mind both actually want to do: eat normally by following the signals of hunger and satiation. Two hormones, leptin and ghrelin, are secreted in a natural biorhythm. When the stomach is empty, its cells secrete ghrelin, sending a message to the brain that you register as feeling hungry. When you've had enough to eat, that's the result of a message from leptin, secreted by fat cells, which balances the hunger-satiation rhythm. In fact, obesity and leptin have both been implicated in risk for Alzheimer's disease. Epidemiological, that is, population studies, have shown higher circulating leptin levels to be associated with lower risk of Alzheimer's, while lower circulating levels of leptin have been found in patients already suffering from the disease. Leptin receptors are highly expressed in the hippocampus, the area of the brain responsible for short-term memory, which is ravaged by Alzheimer's. Leptin supplementation actually led to less Alzheimer's pathology in this brain region in mouse studies of the disease. This is yet further evidence strengthening the link between the gut and the brain. Weight gain. Your body isn't to blame. One reason that early versions of weight loss surgery were unsuccessful is that when a gastric bypass or lap band procedure was performed, the stomach was left intact, with a small portion sealed off in order to drastically reduce how much food a person could eat at any given time. Instead of consuming a complete meal of cheeseburger with fries, less than a third of that would be satisfying, or should have been. Patients reported being extremely hungry even when their smaller stomach pouches were full, and the reason was that the whole stomach was still secreting a full amount of leptin and ghrelin. The lesson here is that you haven't had enough to eat when your stomach is full. You've had enough to eat when your brain says so, specifically the region known as the hypothalamus. When mind and body get separated, however, you can override your brain, or rather you can distort your relationship with your brain. Instead of listening to the natural biorhythm that governs hunger and satiation, you impose your own behaviors. Because you have free will, these can be practically anything. But social norms today are already distorted, which means that you find young children setting in place lifelong habits to which the brain adapts. Continuing to eat after you're full. Eating excessive sugar and fat. Ingesting alcohol. Snacking at all hours. Eating your feelings. Ignoring regular meal times. Consuming an imbalanced or very limited diet, such as a diet very low in vegetables and fiber. Eating too much because you've lost the dieting battle and don't care anymore. Ironically, the blame for the problem is usually placed on the body. The more it gains weight and loses its shape, the more likely a person will judge against his, or more likely her, body for not cooperating. But this lack of cooperation began elsewhere, in the weakened mind-body connection. Let's look a bit deeper. As we already noted, two hormones, leptin and ghrelin, control hunger and satiation. After leptin was first discovered in animals in 1994 by the molecular geneticist Jeffrey Friedman and his colleagues, the New York Times led their story with an air of excitement. It seemed almost too good to be true. A hormone that makes animals, and maybe people, eat less and exercise more. But researchers say that is exactly what they have found. Drug companies were eager from the start to produce a drug to increase leptin levels, which in turn would signal the brain to suppress appetite and increase physical activity. But the story quickly grew more complicated. To begin with, obese people already produce higher levels of leptin because they have more fat cells than people of normal weight. Why doesn't the leptin curb their appetite? No one knows for certain. The relevant factors include leptin resistance, where the receptors for this particular hormone get overloaded. This is similar to the way overproduction of insulin makes a person less sensitive to it. Leptin and ghrelin are also brain chemicals known as neuropeptides. The brain's receptor sites are probably affected by chronic overeating. But the story gets complicated here, because the same region of the brain that contains these receptors, the hypothalamus, is also required to balance overall metabolism and control how much fuel is allocated throughout the body. Other clues point to problems with the pathways that lead from the hypothalamus after it receives leptin, along with the possibility that not enough leptin gets past the blood-brain barrier. Add to this the genetic factor. Mouse studies dating to 2004 at Columbia University indicated that leptin levels early in life can alter the brain's circuitry, influencing how much food is consumed as adults. This seems to correlate with findings that infants who are fed too much run a higher risk of future obesity. To an extent not yet known, leptin may be able to train the brain by changing its circuitry, leading to altered appetite. A person can wind up at either extreme, being hungry for either too much or too little food. It's intriguing that leptin can do this. But you are much more powerful in your ability to train your brain, because you can do it consciously. If you want to close the mind-body gap in relation to how you eat, try the following simple mindfulness experiment. A practice for mindful eating. When you do anything consciously, including eating, you override the brain's default setting and communicate directly with the higher brain, which is responsible for conscious thoughts and actions. Very often, we eat unconsciously, without thinking or weighing the consequences of what we're doing. You can change the situation with a simple mindfulness practice. The next time you eat anything, whether as a meal or a snack, do the following. Step 1. Pause before you eat the first bite and take a deep breath. Step 2. Ask yourself, why am I eating this? Step 3. Whatever answer you get, take note of it. Better yet, write it down. You might even start a mindful eating journal. Step 4. Make a conscious choice to eat or not eat. There is nothing more to do, but this simple practice can lead to major benefits. Your goal is to return to a normal biorhythm of hunger and satiation. When you pause to make a choice, your reason for eating should therefore be, I'm hungry. But there are a host of other reasons we reach for food, like the following. I'm bored. I can't resist. I need comforting. There's no use letting all this food go to waste. I'm stressed out. I feel a craving. I'm depressed. I'm anxious. I don't know why. I'm lonely. I'm sick of dieting. The other people I'm with are eating. There's not much left. I might as well finish the package. I feel like celebrating. When you ask yourself why you are eating, it's likely that some of these reasons will come into play. Don't judge against them, and don't force yourself to reject the food out of guilt. Mindfulness is a conscious state, nothing more or less. In this state, you are self-aware, and that's the key. When you are self-aware, change comes with less effort than in any other state. The end of unconscious eating is often enough to turn around a person's weight problems, especially if they are mild to moderate. As you can see, there is hope beyond dieting, a way forward for people who moan, I've tried everything, nothing works. A whole system approach to weight loss ends the struggle. No longer is your body the enemy and you its victim. The Conscious Dieter. We aren't discounting the value of research into how digestion works. An entire research career could be devoted to studying a single hormone like leptin. Some already are. And even then, its promise for weight reduction may remain out of reach. The drug industry offers a host of over-the-counter and prescription diet pills, from so-called fat burners to appetite suppressants. But they are either unproven, ineffective, laden with side effects, or clinically insignificant. At the same time, a host of self-defeating beliefs will stop having power over you. In the psychology of overeating, there's a vicious circle at work. Painful beliefs turn into excuses. As an example, take the belief, I've always struggled with my weight, so I must have been born to be this way. No attitude is more self-defeating, and there is science to make this belief stick even harder. There are indeed genetic indicators to suggest that some people are likely to gain weight. For example, it's invaluable to know the specific gene that modulates how much leptin is produced, because in some obese individuals, a mutation in this gene causes leptin deficiency, leading to uncontrollable weight gain. The story of leptin is interwoven with the story of obesity in the general public, and every clue is worth pursuing. But we covered how misleading the early promise of leptin turned out to be, and in the same vein, the search for a single fat gene has been equally fruitless. At best, your genes account for only a percentage of the causes for being overweight. Other factors are at work that you can change, such as your psychology, eating habits, and attitudes passed on by your family as a child. These factors are subject to free will when you learn how to change them. The good news is that when change occurs, your genes will respond, altering their activity in the direction of healing this problem. Many other beliefs keep the vicious circle going by turning guilt into an excuse. How many of the following have you bought into? The belief that food can make you happy when you're sad. The belief that being full is a state of fulfillment. The belief that known risk factors, high fat, sugar, and salt, don't apply to you. You are protected by magical thinking. The belief, this time unconscious, that the food you don't remember eating doesn't count. The belief that you don't really care how much you weigh. The belief that you don't mind what other people think. These beliefs all deliver a double whammy. They give you an excuse to fall back on, but the excuses stoke defeat. The better the excuse, the worse the failure. In our approach, being realistic means that you break the vicious circle by exchanging fantasy for reality. We are counting on the positive effects of realism. Even though many people look at their weight issues and fear the pain of confronting themselves, looking in the mirror is already painful enough. It takes time, but consciousness is its own reward. In our own experience with meditation, for example, we've seen people return to normal weight effortlessly. The enjoyment of being alive and awake took the place of eating. And when that happens, the whole system begins to normalize. You only realize the futility of fighting your body when you free yourself from duality. You are here to enjoy your thoughts, feelings, desires, and hopes. We've singled out weight issues because they strike close to home for millions of people. And because making weight loss a pleasurable part of personal growth is the last thing most dieters think is possible. But in the larger scheme, conscious living is the goal. Now that we've established how important it is to heal the separation of mind and body, let's unfold the enormous fulfillment that comes from living consciously every day. 7. Mindful or mindless? When we last met Harvard professor Ellen Langer, she was astonishing the psychology world by sending 70-year-old men into a time capsule and bringing them out seemingly younger. But time travel isn't applicable to everyday life. Having proved her point in spectacular fashion, Langer took up a larger cause, mindfulness. We've been using this term also, showing how being mindful reaches beyond the word's old association with Eastern spiritual practices. Langer has totally westernized mindfulness with the following definition. Mindfulness, she said before a medical school audience, is the process of actively noticing new things, relinquishing preconceived mindsets, and then acting on the new observations. Our goal here, of unfolding a healing lifestyle, includes the same things. Langer was very blunt. Everyday behavior is mindless most of the time. One of her favorite examples, she said, comes from personal experience. I once went to make a purchase, and I gave the cashier my credit card, and she saw it wasn't signed. Langer dutifully signed the card, and the cashier ran it through the machine. She asked Langer to sign the receipt. The cashier then compared the two signatures to make sure they were the same person, Langer recalled. She paused and it took a moment before the audience caught on and started to laugh. Why would two signatures need to be compared when you've just witnessed the same person signing both? Small instances of mindless behavior tie us to the past and block the possibility of being alive in the moment, alert to possibilities we will never see. In fact, Langer calls her pursuit of mindfulness the psychology of possibility. In this book, we leap ahead to the ultimate possibility, being conscious all the time. But is that feasible when someone is inundated with deadlines, bills, their children's schooling, and so forth? With so much stress and tension being lobbed at us from so many directions, attention gets dulled. We become reactive rather than attentive. This is how mindfulness gets lost despite our best intentions. Pause for a moment, though, and reflect on how your day has been going. If you're like most people, you will find yourself spending much of your time in reactions rather than paying attention and being mindful of what's going on. As a result, you are living unconsciously while accepting that this is normal. Which of the following things apply to you? What an unconscious day is like. You eat irregularly or on the run. You consume packaged or fast food. You feel bad about your body or your weight, just as you did the day before and will the day after. You act rushed and pressured. You listen to your spouse and kids without really listening. You react negatively towards someone without examining why this is necessary or right. You don't notice anything beautiful for the entire day. You worry about a nagging problem with no plan to solve it. You habitually take a dim view of the future. You are haunted by something painful from your past. You feel stuck and unfulfilled. You feel insecure or unsafe. You are lonely. You lash out at a friend without thinking. You play the victim. You fail to stand up for yourself. You behave like a people pleaser. You go along to get along. It's amazing how many unconscious reactions and behaviors are taken to be normal. What's really going on is that mindlessness is being normalized. Only by seeing this can you begin to change. There's a major shift toward healing when you decide to stop allowing unconscious negative events to have power over you. There's a spectrum of possibilities here, which can be pictured with a simple diagram of unconscious and conscious, separated by a two-way arrow. This is a non-judgmental way of depicting disaster and fulfillment. At the far left would be a totally unconscious lifestyle, where everything that needs to be healed is unattended to, which ultimately leads to a disaster. At the other end is a completely conscious lifestyle, where every potential problem is paid attention to, making room for complete fulfillment. Few of us live at either extreme, completely in heaven or hell. We find ourselves somewhere in the middle. Sometimes we act unconsciously. Sometimes we act with self-awareness. This gray zone becomes normal and acceptable, without the realization of the damage being caused over time. Brenda's story. A tale from the gray zone. Several years ago, a woman we'll call Brenda caught a winter cold. The cold didn't go away immediately, but kept coming back. She put up with it, annoyed by the hacking cough that developed. Then, with great suddenness, a fever set in. This, too, she ignored, until one night the roof caved in. I was sitting up in bed, sweating and very weak. My husband is a very caring man. He held me, reassuring me that everything would be okay. but I knew I was very sick. A friend dropped by with some chicken soup. She happens to be a nurse, and after taking one look, she ordered me to go to the emergency room immediately, Brenda recalls. This intervention probably saved her life, because the ER doctor told Brenda that she had pneumonia in both lungs, which severely compromised her respiration. In fact, she was on the point of respiratory failure and had to be put on a ventilator. The normal treatment with antibiotics will generally knock the infection out, but a blood test revealed that Brenda, unknown to herself, was diabetic. She had struggled with her weight since early adolescence, and type 2 diabetes is very common in obesity. To keep her from fighting the ventilator, the doctors kept her in an unconscious state, sometimes called an induced coma, with massive doses of Valium. It was a drastic course, but they needed to carefully control and monitor her treatment. I was stunned. 2 days before, it was just a cold, and now they were telling me I could die, she says. My life became a nightmare overnight. For the next 19 days, it was touch and go. Being totally knocked out was interrupted by intervals in which she was brought back into a blurry state of wakefulness. The doctors did this in order to check on how she was faring medically, but Brenda found these episodes terrifying. I'd wake up feeling totally anxious, wondering if I was about to die. I had no control over my body anymore, and I was laid out in bed with needles and IV tubes and beeping monitors. It was the worst thing that ever happened to me. Brenda wasn't prepared for how hard everything was, and when the doctors told her she was out of danger, that the pneumonia was gone, she went home still feeling anxious. She kept telling friends about her brush with death, reinforcing her sense of inner dread and loss of control. In some ways, she'd stayed in crisis mode, which wasn't at all like her. At 53, Brenda considered herself a strong woman who had spent a lifetime striving to get ahead. She was much more than a survivor. Born in a poor working-class family, she never got past high school, but she knew inside that she was different from the rest of her family. She was more aware of what life could offer. And with determination, she set out at 18 to write her own story. I saw girls my age getting pregnant too early, settling into marriages they didn't want or just thought they wanted. The men had dead-end jobs, most of them, and spent a lot of time drinking beer in front of the TV. It wasn't hard for me to leave it all behind, she says. She had gone out into the world and made something of herself. In her own mind, Brenda had great self-control. She was a helper, aiding anyone in need. She started a service to cook food for the homeless and was a leader in community support groups. Over the decades between leaving home and reaching middle age, the conscious side of her life wasn't lacking. But after the bout with pneumonia, everything seemed to unravel. Brenda felt depressed and stopped seeing her friends as often. The dinner party she loved to cook for became much less frequent. On the medical front, her blood sugar came under control with daily insulin injections, but the doctors told her that the damage already caused by her diabetes, in some cases, couldn't be reversed. I was going to 3 specialists a week. My eyesight was being affected by damage to the retina. I began to have terrible intestinal pain, and they told me it was diverticulosis. My cold feet were due to decreased blood flow to my extremities. Brenda laughs harshly. I was falling apart. I couldn't believe it. This apparently sudden drop in the quality of life wasn't sudden. Everything had a history. The longest history belonged to the obesity. From it followed a history of elevated blood sugar levels and other histories for Brenda's damaged circulation, digestion, and eyesight. She deserves sympathy and care. Brenda is seeking both and has gotten them, because the unconscious side of her life is demanding payment. Distressing as her crisis has been, Brenda was leading a normal life with familiar ups and downs. Yet, if you look at it realistically, she was deep in the gray zone. There's an old proverb, "For want of a nail." It comes from a nursery rhyme that was well known to children in the past, before automobiles replaced the horse. For want of a nail, the shoe was lost. For want of a shoe, the horse was lost. For want of a horse, the rider was lost. For want of a rider, the message was lost. For want of a message, the battle was lost. For want of a battle, the kingdom was lost. And all for the want of a horseshoe nail. So what was the nail that Brenda and many, many other people lost? They lost the connection to their bodies, to nature, and to themselves. None of these can be seen in isolation. Your body is how you relate to nature, and when that connection frays, you stop being yourself. By becoming more and more aware that the thoughts you think today and the actions that follow from those ideas and emotions are impacting your body in real time, your life gets transformed at every level. The word level is misleading, however, because the body-mind merges everything into a single consciousness of who you are and what is happening to you. Many of us have heard that what's in the past is in the past, yet your present state is a result of your past. In many ways, the two are inseparable. We can't change the past, but we can change the present. A skeptic would raise a hand and object. Brenda's story is about medical issues that she had no power to heal. Consciousness is all well and good as a lofty aim, but everyone has medical issues that require treatment. How could someone in Brenda's predicament help herself by the time she was a patient? This is a polite rendition of a skeptical argument that's often rude and hard-nosed. The myth that only drugs and surgery are real medicine dies hard. We all wind up going to the doctor's office for various reasons. That doesn't negate the healing self, but only gives it another area to deal with. Worry and the immune system. As we mentioned earlier, mainstream medicine is biological, believing that the mind must be centered only in the brain. In fact, not just doctors, but most scientists who consider the issue would declare that brain equals mind. We've been steadily breaking down the validity of this assumption, and it is an assumption, not a fact, by pointing to the intelligence displayed by the body-mind. The information superhighway of the body-mind delivers messages to and from every cell using the same chemicals as nerve cells. What this implies is that cells are more mindful than we are. Take the immune system as an example. Unless it breaks down in some way, the immune system is never mindless. But if you engage in mindless behavior, the effect is far-reaching and can compromise the intelligence of immune cells. Let's go deeper into this interaction by introducing the growing field of psychoneuroimmunology, PNI, which studies the interaction of mental activity with the immune system. PNI is one of the few areas in which the traditional division between physical disorders and psychological disorders isn't compartmentalized. We've already touched on how long-term bereavement can take its toll on a person's health, including their ability to fend off disease. During the first two grief-stricken semesters at school after his father's sudden premature death from a heart attack, Rudy remembers being constantly assailed with colds he couldn't shake off. He didn't know at the time about the mind-body connection, that turns sorrow into compromised immunity. The damaging effects of grief can also be quite rapid. In a study involving 100,000 recently widowed spouses, death rates doubled in the first week of mourning. Since the mind is everywhere, imbuing every cell, PNI could potentially apply to any mental state as it affects the immune system. We'll confine ourselves to a mental activity everyone is familiar with: worry. Worry is mindless in a host of ways. It obsessively occupies the mind and keeps the person in a state of stressful anxiety. It blocks rational solutions to problems and on its own does nothing to provide a solution. Despite its lack of utility, worry is endemic in society. After the 2016 presidential election, for example, Gallup polls showed an immediate sharp upturn in worry. But turbulent politics and presidential races in general increase the public's level of worry. There's anxiety about the future, which is the hallmark of all worrying. Worry can also serve a purpose. It motivates us to prepare for the worst and to get ready to face an oncoming challenge or threat. This is presumably why worry has been preserved as an evolutionary trait. But when it becomes constant and uncontrollable, chronic worry can be very detrimental to health. Specifically, PNI research has shown that excessive worrying can compromise the immune system and contribute to a host of disorders, from heart disease to Alzheimer's. Worry is based in unease and is just a stone's throw away from dis-ease. For anyone who maintains that all you need to do is replace worry with hope, it's important to note that worrying whether something bad will happen isn't the exact opposite of hoping something good will happen. In both cases, there is an underlying uncertainty and insecurity about the future, which is accompanied by anxiety. Yet, insofar as hope is a positive emotion linked to other positive emotions, like optimism and acceptance, the balance tilts greatly in its favor. While chronic negative emotions can literally kill, a positive outlook can help the outcome of diseases as diverse as cancer and HIV/AIDS. Conditions like asthma and psoriasis, eczema, can be improved by positive feelings and worsened by stress, depression, and anxiety. By what mechanisms do these effects, positive and negative, actually work? This is the main thrust of PNI, which traces its origins to the work of psychologist Robert Ader, former director of the University of Rochester's Center for Psychoneuroimmunology Research. In 1974, Ader and his colleagues gave laboratory rats water sweetened with saccharin, followed by a chemical, cytoxin, that suppressed their immune systems and made them nauseous. When the experimenters later force-fed the rats with saccharin, even in very small amounts, the animals subsequently died. The more saccharin they were fed, the more quickly the rats died. Ader concluded that after sufficient conditioning, the taste of saccharin alone was enough to suppress the immune system, directly causing a weakened immune response and thus leading to fatal bacterial and viral infections the rats would have normally been able to fight off. For the first time, the intimate connection between the brain and immune system was being uncovered, giving birth to the field of psychoneuroimmunology, a term Ader coined. The notion that the immune system was totally autonomous had been radically challenged, the start of many findings along the same lines. In 1981, neuroscientist David Felton, then at Indiana University School of Medicine, later at the University of Rochester, made another major discovery by connecting nerves in the thymus and spleen directly to immune system cells. In 1985, the soon-to-be-celebrated neuroscientist and pharmacologist Candace Pert made a crucial breakthrough by discovering special miniature proteins in the nervous system called neuropeptides that interact with both neurons in the brain and immune cells. The effects can be long-lasting. Neuropeptides strengthen synapses and even change gene expression in both nerve cells and immune cells. Pert's revolutionary studies, which were fundamental to understanding how the body's messaging network operates, went on to prove that neuropeptides were involved with a wide range of activities from social behavior to reproduction, as well as immune response. Perhaps nothing has been more studied in PNI than the effects of stress, which keeps cropping up in every aspect of how people heal differently. In connection with immunity, chronic stress can suppress the immunity needed for rapidly fighting off infections, innate immunity, or to make antibodies to defend against invading germs, adaptive immunity. Chronic stress has been associated with frequent severe infections and also with worse prognoses for cancer, heart disease, and HIV/AIDS. Worry is a form of self-created stress associated with fear, and in part two, we devote a lengthy section to stress reduction. As intriguing as the findings of PNI have been in pinpointing the biology of the mind-body connection, the power of that connection is still underappreciated. Pointedly relevant here is the case of Norman Cousins, longtime editor of the Saturday Review, a peace activist, and in his later years, a highly influential author on mind-body healing. His spontaneous discovery that laughter has healing power was once widely discussed, but it's worth repeating the details as recounted on the website Laughter Online University. In 1964, following a very stressful trip to Russia, Cousins was diagnosed with ankylosing spondylitis, a degenerative disease causing the breakdown of collagen, which left him in almost constant pain and motivated his doctor to say he would die within a few months. He disagreed and reasoned that if stress had somehow contributed to his illness, he was not sick before the trip to Russia, then positive emotions should help him feel better. With his doctor's consent, he checked himself out of the hospital and into a hotel across the street and began taking extremely high doses of vitamin C while exposing himself to a continuous stream of humorous films and similar laughing matters. He later claimed that 10 minutes of belly-rippling laughter would give him 2 hours of pain-free sleep when nothing else, not even morphine, could help him. His condition steadily improved, and he slowly regained the use of his limbs. Within 6 months, he was back on his feet, and within 2 years, he was able to return to his full-time job at the Saturday Review. His story baffled the scientific community and inspired a number of research projects. Cousins began a personal crusade to publicize his remarkable recovery and its implications for medicine, meeting with popular success, but receiving strong resistance from the medical community, which was still a decade away from Ader's experiments, with rats dying from the taste of saccharin. Cousins's story is first cousin to the placebo-nocebo effect. Over 50 years later, figuring out how to channel the mind-body connection into healing remains more mystery than science. But perhaps the simplest lesson is the one Cousins learned at the outset, that turning worry and anxiety into laughter can make all the difference. At the doctor's, be your own advocate. There's a larger lesson to be learned from Cousins' healing, which has to do with not accepting medical treatment passively. As he recounted to a radio interviewer, "I asked my doctor about my chances for full recovery. He leveled with me, admitting that one of the specialists had told him I had one chance in 500. The specialist had also stated that he had not personally witnessed a recovery from this comprehensive condition. All this gave me a great deal to think about. Up until that time, I had been more or less disposed to let the doctors worry about my condition. But now, I felt a compulsion to get into the act. It seemed clear to me that if I was to be that one in 500, I had better be something more than a passive observer. When the average person goes to the doctor, shows up at the ER, or enters the hospital, the possibility of controlling what happens next is minimal. We put ourselves in the hands of the medical machine, which in reality rests upon individual people, doctors, nurses, physicians' assistants, and so on. Human behavior involves lapses and mistakes, and these get magnified in medical care, where misreading a patient's chart or failing to notice a specific symptom can be a matter of life and death. The riskiness of high-tech medicine like gene therapy and toxic cancer treatments is dramatically increased because there is a wider range of mistakes the more complex any treatment is. To be fair, doctors do their utmost to save patients who would have been left to die a generation ago, but they are successful only a percentage of the time. Risk and mistakes go together, but the general public has limited knowledge of the disturbing facts. Medical errors are estimated to cause 440,000 deaths per year in U.S. hospitals alone. It is widely believed that this figure could be grossly inaccurate because countless mistakes go unreported. Death reports offer only the immediate cause, and many doctors band together to protect the reputation of their profession. The total direct expense of adverse events, as medical mistakes are known, is estimated at hundreds of billions of dollars annually. Indirect expenses such as lost economic productivity from premature death and unnecessary illness exceed $1 trillion per year. Statistics barely touch upon the fear involved when any patient thinks about being at the wrong end of a medical mistake. What the patient is all too aware of is the doctor visit that goes by in the blink of an eye. A 2007 analysis of optimal primary care visits found that they last 16 minutes on average. From 1 to 5 minutes is spent discussing each topic that's raised. This figure is at the high end of estimates, given that, according to other studies, the actual face-to-face time spent with a doctor or other healthcare provider actually comes down to 7 minutes on average. Doctors place the primary blame on increasing demands for them to fill out medical reports and detailed insurance claims. Patients tend to believe that doctors want to cram in as many paying customers as they can, or simply that the patient as a person doesn't matter very much. Along these lines, in 2016, renowned cardiologist Dr. John Levinson and Dr. Caleb Gardner published an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal titled, "Turn Off the Computer and Listen to the Patient." They maintained that the introduction of electronic medical records, which are currently mandated by health systems and government, has degraded relationships between clinicians and our patients, and contributed to the corporatization and deprofessionalization of U.S. healthcare. These concerned doctors support the Laun Institute in Boston, a not-for-profit committed to restoring professionalism and a sense of caring to healthcare. While they believe there is a rightful place for medical computing, all too often doctors have to spend more time dealing with our medical forms than talking with the patient. As a result, there's a new movement afoot to provide a personal advocate who stays in the doctor's office with the patient. The advocate is basically someone who represents the patient's best interests in any medical situation. The person might be a well-meaning relative who helps an older patient understand what's going on, or who steps in to do attendant tasks like picking up prescriptions and organizing medical bills. But more and more, one sees the need for an advocate who's professionally trained to buffer the mounting risks in a healthcare system in which less and less time is spent between doctor and patient. If we return to Brenda's situation, the absence of an advocate proved critical in several ways. First and foremost, she wasn't told about the connection between obesity and type 2 diabetes. If that had been done in advance years ago, the downward spiral in her health could have been prevented. Brenda popped in and out of doctors' offices all the time, but what she was treated for was narrowly defined by the symptoms she exhibited that week. No one put the whole story together, and yet it was not the most complex story. So what happened? It would be up to an advocate to find out. And needless to say, this has created hostility from some doctors. Used to ruling their domain with absolute authority, few doctors want an overseer in the room asking questions, inserting their own opinions, and potentially finding fault. At worst, the specter of a malpractice suit looms. The movement for professional advocates, which is quite young, insists that looking out for a patient's best interests is benign. The medical profession has its doubts. The upshot, for now at least, is that patients who want an advocate must play the role themselves. At the heart of the problem is passivity. When we surrender to medical care, whether at the doctor's office, the ER, or the hospital, we shouldn't surrender everything. Poking and prodding is intrusive. Undergoing various tests can be stressful. The minute we walk in the door, we become largely anonymous. A walking set of symptoms replaces the person. There are doctors and nurses who take these negative effects seriously and who go out of their way to offer a personal touch. They should be saluted for their humane compassion in a system that focuses more on impersonal efficiency. You may like your doctor and feel that he or she cares, but this doesn't rule out being your own advocate. Quite the opposite. The inherent stress in medical treatment is what you want to counter. First comes the stress of worry and anticipation, what is commonly known as white coat syndrome. We all remember how afraid we became as children thinking about getting a shot from the school nurse, or how scary it was sitting in the dentist's chair even before the drill was turned on. Studies have verified that anticipating a stressful situation can cause as great a stress response as actually undergoing the stress. In one study, subjects were divided into two groups, one of which gave a public speech while the other was told that they were going to give a speech but actually didn't. Both groups became stressed out, but the researchers wanted to measure how well they recovered from the stress. Recovery involved three things: having heart rate and breathing return to normal, as well as reporting lowered emotional responses like anxiety. The recovery was similar in both groups, indicating that a stress you anticipated but never went through could potentially be just as damaging as the real stressor. Also, how people reported their emotional state as they were recovering was a good predictor of what their heart and respiration were doing. In other words, if you feel emotionally stressed out, your body does too. No surprise on this point. How does this apply to going to the doctors? First, as we mentioned, there is stress in anticipation as well as stress once you get there. Second, under stress, people become mentally confused and distracted. Third, the stress is likely to be highest when the doctor or nurse enters the room, at the very moment when you need to be clear-headed. As your own advocate, you don't want to succumb to stress at any point. Your goal is to ask the right questions, get helpful answers, and understand what lies in store for the future. Everyone knows the frustration of leaving the doctor's office and suddenly remembering all the things you meant to ask, but either forgot to or were too stressed out to bring up. One big secret to overcoming the stress of medical care is to realize that it is affecting you and how.